Brook no further attacks upon my wall.
One realm, one god, one king, cried Lady Melisandre. The queen's men took up the cry, beating the butts of their spears against their shields.
One realm, one god, one king. Stannis, Stannis, one realm, one god, one king.
Val did not join the chant, he saw, nor did the brothers of the Night's Watch. During the tumult, the few remaining wildlings melted into the trees. The giants were the last to go, two riding on the back of a mammoth, the other two afoot. Only the dead were left behind. John watched Stannis descend from the platform with Melisandre by his side, his red shadow. She never leaves his side for long. The king's honor guard fell in around them. Sir Godfrey, Sir Clayton, and a dozen other knights, queen's men all. Moonlight shimmered on their armor, and the wind whipped at their cloaks. Lord Stuart, John told Marsh, break up that stockade for firewood, and throw the corpses in the flames.
As my lord commands.
Marsh barked out orders, and a swarm of his Stuarts broke from ranks to attack the wooden walls. The Lord Stuart watched them, frowning. These wildlings, do you think they will keep faith, my lord? Some will, not all. We have our cowards and our knaves, our weaklings and our fools, as do they. Our vows, we are sworn to protect the realm. Once the free folk are settled in the gift, they will become part of the realm, John pointed out. These are desperate days, and like to grow more desperate. We have seen the face of our real foe, a dead white face with bright blue eyes. The free folk have seen that face as well. Stannis is not wrong in this. We must make common cause with the wildlings.
Common cause against the common foe, I could agree with that, said Bowen Marsh, but that does not mean we should allow tens of thousands of half-starved savages through the wall.
Let them return to their villages and fight the others there, whilst we seal the gates. It will not be difficult, Athel tells me. We need only fill the tunnels with chunks of stone and pour water through the murder holes. The wall does the rest. The kill, the weight, in a moon's turn, it will be as if no gate had ever been. Any foe would need to hack his way through.
Or climb.
Oh, unlikely, said Bowen Marsh. These are not raiders, out to steal a wife and some plunder. Tormund will have old women with him, children, herds of sheep and goats, even mammoths. He needs a gate, and only three of those remain. And if he should send climbers up, well, defending against climbers is as simple as spearing fish in a kettle.
Fish never climb out of the kettle and shove a spear through your belly.
John had climbed the wall himself.
Marsh went on. Men's raiders, Bowman, must have loosed 10,000 arrows at us, judging from the number of spent shafts we've gathered up. Fewer than 100 reached our men atop the wall, most of those lifted by some errant gust of wind. Red Allen of the Rosewood was the only man to die up there, and it was his fall that killed him, not the arrow that pricked his leg. Donald Noy died to hold the gate. A gallant act, yes. But if the gate had been sealed, our brave armourer might still be with us. Whether we face 100 foes or 100,000, so long as we're atop the wall and they're below, they cannot do us harm.
He's not wrong. Man's raider's host had broken against the wall like a wave upon a stony shore, though the defenders were no more than a handful of old men, green boys, and cripples. Yet what Bowen was suggesting went against all of John's instincts. If we seal the gates, we cannot send out rangers, he pointed out. We will be as good as blind.
Lord Mormont's last ranging cost the watch a quarter of its men, my lord. We need to conserve what strength remains us. Every death diminishes us, and we are stretched so thin. Take the high ground and win the battle, my uncle used to say. No ground is higher than the wall, Lord Commander.
Stannis promises land, food, and justice to any wildlings who bend the knee. He will never permit us to seal the gates. Marsh hesitated.
Lord Snow, I'm not one to bear tales, but there has been talk that you are becoming too friendly with Lord Stannis. Some even suggest that you are
a rebel and a turncloak, aye, and a bastard and a warg as well. Janus Slint might be gone, but his lies lingered. I know what they say. John had heard the whispers, had seen men turn away when you crossed the yard. What would they have me do? Take up swords against Stannis and the wildlings both? His grace has thrice the fighting men we do, and is our guest besides. The laws of hospitality protect him, and we owe him and his a debt.
Lord Stannis helped us when we needed help, Marsh said doggedly. But he is still a rebel, and his cause is doomed as we'll be if the Iron Throne marks us down as traitors. We must be certain that we do not choose the losing side.
It is not my intent to choose any side, said John. But I am not as certain of the outcome of this war as you seem to be, my lord. Not with Lord Tywin dead. If the tales coming up the King's Road could be believed, the King's Hand had been murdered by his dwarf son while sitting on a privy. John had known Tyrion Lannister briefly. He took my hand and named me friend. It was hard to believe the little man had it in him to murder his own sire. But the fact of Lord Tywin's demise seems to be beyond doubt. The lion in King's Landing is a cub, and the Iron Throne has been known to cut grown men to ribbons.
A boy he may be, my lord, but King Robert was well-loved, and most men still accept that Tommen is his son. The more they say of Lord Stannis, the less they love him, and fewer still are fond of Lady Missandra, with her fires and this grim red guard of hers. They complain. They complained about Lord Commander Mormont, too. Men love to complain about their wives and lords, he told me once. Those without wives complain twice as much about their lords. Jon Snow glanced toward the stockade. Two walls were down, a third falling fast. I will leave you to finish here, Bowen. Make certain every corpse is burnt. Thank you for your counsel. I promise you I will think on all you've said.
Smoke and drifting ash still lingered in the air about the pit as John trotted back to the gate. There he dismounted to walk his garron through the ice to the south side. Dolorous Ed went before him with a torch. Its flames licked the ceiling. So cold tears trickled down upon them with every step.
"It was a relief to see that orn burn, my lord," Ed said. "Just last night I dreamed I was pissing off the wall when someone decided to give the orn a toot. Not that I'm complaining. It was better than my old dream, where Harmer Dog's Head was feeding me to her pigs."
"Harmer's dead," John said.
"But not the pigs. They look at me the way Slayer used to look at him. Not to say that the wildlings mean us harm. I we act their gods apart and made them burn the pieces, but we gave them onion soup. What's a god compared to a nice bowl of onion soup, eh? Oh, I could do with one myself."
The odors of smoke and burned flesh still clung to John's blacks. He knew he had to eat, but it was company he craved, not food. A cup of wine with Maester Aemon, some quiet words with Sam, a few laughs with Pip and Gren and Toad. Aemon and Sam were gone, though, and his other friends. "I will take supper with the men this evening."
"Boiled beef and beets," Dolorous Ed always seemed to know what was cooking. "Ob says he's out of horseradish, though. What good is boiled beef without horseradish?"
Since the wildlings had burned the old common hall, the men of the Night's Watch took their meals in the stone cellar below the armory, a cavernous space divided by two rows of square stone pillars, with barrel-vaulted ceilings and great casks of wine and ale along the walls. When John entered, four builders were playing at tiles at the table nearest the steps. Closer to the fire sat a group of rangers and a few kingsmen, talking quietly. The younger men were gathered at another table, where Pip had stabbed a turnip with his knife.
"The night is dark and full of turnips," he announced in a solemn voice. "Let us all pray for venison, my children, with some onions and a bit of tasty gravy."
His friends laughed. Grin, Toad, Satin, the whole lot of them. Jon Snow did not join the laughter. Making mock of another man's prayer is fool's work, Pip, and dangerous.
"If the Red Guard's offended, let him strike me down."
All the smiles had died.
"It was the priestess we were laughing at," said Saturn, a lithe and pretty youth who had once been a horn in Old Town. "We were only having a jape, my lord."
"You have your guards and she has hers. Leave her be."
"She won't let her guards be," argued Toad. "She calls the seven false guards, my lord. The old gods, too. She made the wildlings burn weirwood branches, you saw."
"Lady Melisandre is not part of my command. You are. I won't have bad blood between the king's men and my own." Pip laid a hand on Toad's arm.
"Croak no more, brave Toad, for our great Lord Snow has spoken."
Pip hopped to his feet and gave John a mocking bow.
"I beg pardon. Henceforth I shall not even waggle my ears save by your lordship's lordly leave."
"He thinks this is all some game." John wanted to shake some sense into him. "Waggle your ears all you like. It's your tongue waggling that makes the trouble." "I'll see that he's more careful," Gren promised, "and I'll clout him if he's not." He hesitated.
"My lord, will you sup with us? Owen, shove over, make room for John."
John wanted nothing more. No, he had to tell himself, those days are gone. The realization twisted in his belly like a knife. They had chosen him to rule. The wall was his, and their lives were his as well.
"A lord may love the men that he commands," he could hear his lord father saying, "but he cannot be a friend to them. One day he may need to sit in judgment on them, or send them forth to die."
"Another day," the Lord Commander lied. "Ed, best see to your own supper. I have work to finish." The outside air seemed even colder than before. Across the castle he could see candlelight shining from the windows of the king's tower. Val stood on the tower roof, gazing up at the wall. Stannis kept her closely pinned in rooms above his own, but he did allow her to walk the battlements for exercise. She looked lonely, John thought, lonely and lovely. Ygritte had been pretty in her own way, with her red hair kissed by fire, but it was her smile that made her face come alive. Val did not need to smile. She would have turned men's heads in any court in the wide world. All the same, the wildling princess was not beloved of her jailers. She scorned them all as kneelers, and had thrice attempted to escape. When one man-at-arms grew careless in her presence, she had snatched his dagger from its sheath and stabbed him in the neck. Another inch to the left, and he might have died. Lonely and lovely and lethal, Jon Snow reflected. And I might have had her, her, and Winterfall, and my lord father's name. Instead, he had chosen a black cloak and a wall of ice. Instead, he had chosen honor, a bastard sort of honor. The wall loomed on his right as he crossed the yard. Its high ice glimmered palely, but down below all was shadow. At the gate, a dim orange glow shone through the bars where the guards had taken refuge from the wind. John could hear the creak of chains as the winch cage swung and scraped against the ice. Up top, the sentries would be huddling in the warming shed around a brazier, shouting to be heard above the wind. Or else they would have given up the effort and each man would be sunk in his own pool of silence. "I should be walking the ice. The wall is mine." He was walking beneath the shell of the Lord Commander's tower, past the spot where Ygritte had died in his arms, when Ghost appeared beside him, his warm breath steaming in the cold. In the moonlight, his red eyes glowed like pools of fire. The taste of hot blood filled John's mouth. and he knew that Ghost had killed that night. No, he thought, I am a man, not a wolf. He rubbed his mouth with the back of a gloved hand and spat. Clyda still occupied the rooms beneath the rookery. At John's knock, he came shuffling, a taper in his hand, to open the door a crack. "Do I intrude?" asked John.
"Not at all."
Clydes opened the door wider.
"I was mulling wine. Would your lord take a cup?"
"With pleasure." His hands were stiff from cold. He pulled off his gloves and flexed his fingers. Clydes returned to the hearth to stir the wine. "He's 60 if he's a day. An old man. He only seemed young compared with Amon. Short and round, he had the dim pink eyes of some nocturnal creature. A few white hairs clung to his scalp. When Clydes poured, John held the cup with both hands, sniffed the spices, swallowed. The warmth spread through his chest. He drank again, long and deep, to wash the taste of blood from his mouth.
"The Queen's men are saying that the king beyond the wall died craven, that he cried for mercy and denied he was a king."
"He did. Lightbringer was brighter than I'd ever seen it, as bright as the sun." John raised his cup. "To Stannis Baratheon and his magic sword." The wine was bitter in his mouth.
"His grace is not an easy man. Few are who wear the crown. Many good men have been bad kings, Maester Aemon used to say, and some bad men have been good kings."
"He would know. Aemon Targaryen had seen 9 kings upon the Iron Throne. He had been a king's son, a king's brother, a king's uncle. I looked at that book Maester Aemon left me, the Jade Compendium. The pages are told of Azor Ahai. Lightbringer was his sword, tempered with his wife's blood, if Votar can be believed. Thereafter, Lightbringer was never cold to the touch, but warm as Nyssa Nyssa had been warm. In battle, the blade burned fiery hot. Once Azor Ahai fought a monster. When he thrust his sword through the belly of the beast, its blood began to boil. Smoke and steam poured from its mouth. Its eyes melted and dribbled down its cheeks, and its body burst into flame. Clydes blinked.
"A sword that makes its own heat?"
"Would be a fine thing on the wall." John put aside his wine cup and drew on his black moleskin gloves. "A pity that the sword that Stannis wields is cold. I'd be curious to see how his Lightbringer behaves in battle. Thank you for the wine. Ghost, with me." Jon Snow raised the hood of his cloak and pulled at the door. The white wolf followed him back into the night. The armory was dark and silent. Jon nodded to the guards before making his way past the silent racks of spears to his rooms. He hung his sword belt from a peg beside the door and his cloak from another. When he peeled off his gloves, his hands were stiff and cold. It took him a long while to get the candles lit. Ghost curled up on his rug and went to sleep, but John could not rest yet. The scarred pinewood table was covered with maps of the wall and the lands beyond. A roster of rangers and a letter from the Shadow Tower written in Sir Dennis Malister's flowing hand. He read the letter from the Shadow Tower again, sharpened a quill, and unstoppered a pot of thick black ink. He wrote 2 letters, the first to Sir Dennis, the second to Cotter Pike. Both of them had been hounding him for more men. Holder and Toad he dispatched west to the Shadow Tower, Gren and Pip to Eastwatch by the sea. The ink would not flow properly, and all his words seemed curt and crude and clumsy, yet he persisted. When he finally put the quill down, the room was dim and chilly, and he could feel its walls closing in. Perched above the window, the old bear's raven peered down at him with shrewd black eyes. "My last friend," John thought ruefully, "and I had best outlive you, or you'll eat my face as well." Ghost did not count. Ghost was closer than a friend. Ghost was part of him. John rose and climbed the steps to the narrow bed that had once been Donal Noyes. "This is my lot," he realized as he undressed. "From now until the end of my days." Daenerys.
"What is it?"
she cried, as Eri shook her gently by the shoulder. It was the black of night outside.
"Something is wrong,"
she knew at once.
"Is it Dario? What's happened?"
In her dream, they had been man and wife, simple folk who lived a simple life in a tall stone house with a red door. In her dream, he had been kissing her all over, her mouth, her neck, her breasts.
"No, Khaleesi," Eri murmured. "It is your eunuch, Grey Worm, and the bald men. Will you see them?"
Yes.
Her hair was disheveled, and her bedclothes all tangled, Danny realized.
Help me dress. I'll have a cup of wine as well, to clear my head.
To drown my dream. She could hear the soft sounds of sobs.
Who is that weeping?
Your slave, Miss Andy.
Jeque had a taper in her hand.
My servant. I have no slaves.
Danny did not understand.
Why does she weep? For him who was her brother,
Eri told her. The rest she had from Skarhaz, Resnek, and Grey Worm, when they were ushered into her presence. Danny knew their tidings were bad before a word was spoken. One glance at the shaved pate's ugly face sufficed to tell her that.
The sons of the Harpy.
Skarhaz nodded. His mouth was grim.
How many dead?
Resnek wrung his hands.
Nine, magnificence. Foul work it was, and wicked. A dreadful night. Dreadful.
Nine? The word was a dagger in her heart. Every night the Shadow Wars was waged anew beneath the step pyramids of Meereen. Every morn the sun rose upon fresh corpses, with harpies drawn in blood on the bricks beside them. Any freedman who became too prosperous or too outspoken was marked for death.
Nine in one night, though.
That frightened her.
Tell me.
Grey Worm answered. Your servants were set upon as they walked the breeks of Meereen to keep your grace's peace. All were well armed with spears and shields and short swords. Two by two they walked, and two by two they died. Your servants, Black Fist and Setharis, were slain by crossbow bolts in Mazdan's maze. Your servants, Masador and Duran, were crushed by falling stones beneath the river wall. Your servants, Eladon, Goldenhair, and Loyal Spear, were poisoned at a wine shop, where they were accustomed to stop each night upon their rounds.
Masador?
Danny made a fist. Missandei and her brothers had been taken from their home on Naith by raiders from the Basilisk Isles, and sold into slavery in Astapor. Young as she was, Missandei had shown such a gift for tongues that the good masters had made a scribe of her. Masador and Marcelin had not been so fortunate. They had been gelded and made into unsolid.
Have any of the murderers been captured?
Your servants have arrested the owner of the wine shop and his daughters. They plead their ignorance and beg for mercy.
They all plead ignorance and beg for mercy.
Give them to the shave pate, Skarhaz. Keep each apart from the others and put them to the question.
It will be done, your worship. Would you have me question them sweetly or sharply?
Sweetly, to begin. Hear what tales they tell, and what names they give you. It may be they had no part in this.
She hesitated.
Nine, the noble Resnik said. Who else?
Three freedmen, murdered in their homes, the shave pate said. A moneylender, a cobbler, and the harpist, Rylona Ree. They cut her fingers off before they killed her.
The queen flinched. Rylona Ree had played the harp as sweetly as the maiden. When she had been a slave in Yonkai, she had played for every high-born family in the city. In Meereen, she had become a leader, amongst the Yunkish freedmen, their voice in Danny's councils.
"We have no captives but this wine cellar?"
"None, this one grieves to confess. We beg your pardon."
"Mercy," thought Danny. "They will have the dragon's mercy." "Skahas, I have changed my mind. Question the man sharply."
"I could, or I could question the daughters sharply, whilst the father looks on. That will wring some names from him."
"Do as you think best, but bring me names."
Her fury was a fire in her belly.
"I will have no more unsullied slaughtered. Grey Worm, pull your men back to their barracks. Henceforth, let them guard my walls and gates and person. From this day it shall be for Myrinees to keep the peace in Myrine. Skahas, make me a new watch, made up in equal parts of shave pates and freemen."
"As you command. How many men?"
"As many as you require."
Resnick Mo Resnick gasped.
"Magnificence! Where is the coin to come from to pay wages for so many men?"
"From the pyramids. I call it a blood tax. I will have 100 pieces of gold from every pyramid for each freedman that the harpy's sons have slain."
That brought a smile to the shaved pate's face.
"It will be done," he said. "But your radiance should know that the great masters of Zak and Merrick are making preparations to quit their pyramids and leave the city."
Daenerys was sick unto death of Zak and Merrick. She was sick of all the Myrinees, great and small alike.
"Let them go. But see that they take no more than the clothes upon their backs. Make certain that all their gold remains here with us, their stores of food as well."
"Magnificence," murmured Resnick Mo Resnick. "We cannot know that these great nobles mean to join your enemies. More like, they are simply making for their estates in the hills."
"They will not mind us keeping their gold safe, then. There is nothing to buy in the hills."
"They are afraid for their children," Resnick said.
"Yes," Daenerys thought, "and so am I. We must keep them safe as well. I will have 2 children from each of them, from the other pyramids as well, a boy and a girl."
"Hostages," said Skarhaus happily.
"Pages and cupbearers. If the great masters make objection, explain to them that in Westeros is a great honor for a child to be chosen to serve at court."
She left the rest unspoken.
"Go and do as I've commanded. I have my dead to mourn."
When she returned to her rooms atop the pyramid, she found Missandei crying softly on her pallet, trying as best she could to muffle the sound of her sobs.
"Come, sleep with me," she told the little scribe. "Dawn will not come for hours yet." "Your grace is kind to this one."
Missandei slipped under the sheets.
"He was a good brother."
Danny wrapped her arms about the girl.
"Tell me of him." "He taught me how to climb a tree when we was little. He could catch fish with his hands. Once I found him sleeping in our garden with 100 butterflies crawling over him. He looked so beautiful that morning. I loved him." "As he loved you."
Danny stroked the girl's hair.
"Say the word, my sweet, and I will send you from this awful place. I will find a ship somehow and send you home to Naith. I would sooner stay with you. On Naith I'd be afraid. What if the slavers came again? I feel safe when I'm with you."
"Safe?" The word made Danny's eyes fill up with tears.
"I want to keep you safe."
Missandei was only a child. With her, she felt as if she could be a child too.
"No one ever kept me safe when I was little. Well, Sir Willem did. But then he died. And Viserys, I want to protect you, but it's so hard to be strong. I don't always know what I should do. I must know, though. I am all they have. I am the queen. The
"Mother," whispered Missandei.
"Mother to dragons,"
Danny shivered.
"No, mother to us all."
Missandei hugged her tighter.
Your Grace should sleep. Dawn will be here soon, and court. We'll both sleep, and dream of sweeter days. Close your eyes.
When she did, Danny kissed her eyelids and made her giggle. Kisses came easier than sleep, however. Danny shut her eyes and tried to think of home, of Dragonstone and King's Landing, and all the other places that Viserys had told her of, in a kinder land than this. But her thoughts kept turning back to Slaver's Bay, like ships caught in some bitter wind. When Missandei was sound asleep, Danny slipped from her arms and stepped out into the pre-dawn air to lean upon the cool brick parapet to gaze out across the city. A thousand roofs stretched out below her, painted in shades of ivory and silver by the moon. Somewhere beneath those roofs the sons of the Harpy were gathered, plotting ways to kill her and all those who loved her, and put her children back in chains. Somewhere down there a hungry child was crying for milk. Somewhere an old woman lay dying. Somewhere a man and a maid embraced and fumbled at each other's clothes with eager hands. But up here there was only the sheen of moonlight on pyramids and pits, but no hint what lay beneath. Up here there was only her, alone. She was the blood of the dragon. She could kill the sons of the Harpy, and the sons of the sons, and the sons of the sons of the sons, but a dragon could not feed a hungry child, nor help a dying woman's pain.
And who would ever dare to love a dragon?
She found herself thinking of Dario Naharis once again. Dario, with his gold tooth and triton beard, his strong hands resting on the hilts of his matched arrack and stiletto, hilts wrought of gold in the shape of naked women. The day he took his leave of her, as she was bidding him farewell, he had brushed the balls of his thumbs lightly across them, back and forth.
"I'm jealous of a sword hilt," she had realized, "of women made of gold."
Sending him to the Lamb Men had been wise. She was a queen, and Dario Naharis was not the stuff of kings.
"It has been so long," she had said to Sir Barristan just yesterday. "What if Dario has betrayed me and gone over to my enemies? 3 treasons, will you know? What if he met another woman, some princess of the Lazarene?"
The old knight neither liked nor trusted Dario, she knew. Even so, he had answered gallantly.
"There is no woman more lovely than your grace. Only a blind man could believe otherwise, and Dario Naharis was not blind." "No," she thought. "His eyes are a deep blue, almost purple, and his gold tooth gleams when he smiles for me."
Sir Barristan was sure he would return, though. Danny could only pray that he was right.
"A bath will help soothe me."
She padded barefoot through the grass to her terrace pool. The water felt cool on her skin, raising goosebumps. Little fish nibbled at her arms and legs. She closed her eyes and floated. A soft rustle made her open them again. She sat up with a soft splash. "Missandei," she called. "Here he. Jeeque."
"They sleep," came the answer.
A woman stood under the persimmon tree, clad in a hooded robe that brushed the grass. Beneath the hood, her face seemed hard and shiny.
"She is wearing a mask," Danny knew, a wooden mask, finished in dark red lacquer. "Quaith? Am I dreaming?"
She pinched her ear and winced at the pain.
"I dreamt of you on Balerion, when first we came to Astapor." "You did not dream, then or now. What are you doing here? How did you get past my guards?"
"I came another way. Your guards never saw me."
"If I call out, they will kill you."
"They will swear to you that I am not here."
"Are you here?"
"No. Hear me, Daenerys Targaryen. The glass candles are burning. Soon comes the pale mare, and after her, the others. Kraken and dark flame, lion and griffin, the sun, and the mummer's dragon.
Trust none of them. Remember the undying. Beware the perfume seneschal. Resnack, why should I fear him?
Danny rose from the pool. Water trickled down her legs, and goose flesh covered her arms in the cool night air.
If you have some warning for me, speak plainly. What do you want of me, Quaithe?
Moonlight shone in the woman's eyes.
To show you the way. I remember the way. I go north to go south, east to go west, back to go forward. And to touch the light, I have to pass beneath the shadow.
She squeezed the water from her silvery hair.
I'm half sick of riddling. In Carth I was a beggar, but here I am a queen. I command you.
Daenerys, remember the undying. Remember who you are.
The blood of the dragon.
But my dragons are roaring in the darkness. I remember the undying. Child of three, they called me. Three mounts, they promised me. Three fires and three treasons. One for blood, and one for gold, and one for...
Your Grace.
Miss Sandy stood in the door of the Queen's bedchamber, a lantern in her hand.
Who are you talking to?
Danny glanced back toward the persimmon tree. There was no woman there. No hooded robe, no lacquer mask, no Quaithe.
A shadow. A memory. No one.
She was the blood of the dragon, but Sir Barristan had warned her that in that blood there was a taint.
Could I be going mad?
They had called her father mad once.
I was praying,
she told the Nathy girl.
It will be late soon. I had best eat something before court. I will bring you food to break your fast.
Alone again, Danny went all the way around the pyramid in hopes of finding Quaithe, past the burned trees and scorched earth, where her men had tried to capture Drogon. But the only sound was the wind in the fruit trees, and the only creatures in the gardens were a few pale moths. Miss Handy returned with a melon and a bowl of hard-cooked eggs, but Danny found she had no appetite. As the sky lightened and the stars faded one by one, Eri and Jiqui helped her don a tokar of violet silk, fringed in gold. When Resnick and Skarhaz appeared, she found herself looking at them askance, mindful of the three treasons.
"Beware the perfume seneschal."
She sniffed suspiciously at Resnick Mo Resnick. "I could command the shavepate to arrest him and put him to the question. Would that forestall the prophecy? Or would some other betrayer take his place?
Prophecies are treacherous,
she reminded herself,
and Resnick may be no more than he appears.
In the purple hall, Danny found her ebon bench, piled high about with satin billows. The sight brought a wan smile to her lips. Sir Barristan's work, she knew. The old knight was a good man, but sometimes very literal.
It was only a jape, sir,
she thought. But she sat on one of the pillars just the same. Her sleepless night soon made itself felt. Before long she was fighting off a yawn, as Resnick prattled about the craftsmen's guilds. The stonemasons were wroth with her, it seemed, the bricklayers as well. Certain former slaves were carving stone and laying bricks, stealing work from guild journeymen and masters alike. The freedmen worked too cheaply, magnificence, Resnick said. Some call themselves journeymen, or even masters, titles that belong by rights only to the craftsmen of the guilds. The masons and the bricklayers do respectfully petition your worship to uphold their ancient rights and customs.
The freedmen work cheaply because they are hungry,
Danny pointed out. If I forbid them to carve stone or lay bricks, the chandlers, the weavers, and the goldsmiths will soon be at my gates, asking that they be excluded from those trades as well. She considered a moment.
Let it be written that henceforth only guild members shall be permitted to name themselves journeymen or masters, provided the guilds open their rolls to any freedman who can demonstrate the requisite skills.
So shall it be proclaimed, said Resnick.
Will it please your worship to hear the noble Hisdars O'Lorik?
Will he never admit defeat? Let him step forth.
Hisdar was not in a tokar today. Instead, he wore a simple robe of grey and blue. He was shorn as well.
Oh, he shaved off his beard and cut his hair, she realized.
The man had not gone shave-pate, not quite. But at least those absurd wings of his were gone.
Your barber has served you well, Hisdar. I hope you have come to show me his work, and not to plague me further about the fighting pits.
He made a deep obeisance.
Your grace, I fear I must.
Danae grimaced. Even her own people would give no rest about the matter. Resnick Mo Resnick stressed the coin to be made through Texas. The Green Grace said that reopening the pits would please the gods. The Shave-Pate felt it would win her support against the Sons of the Harpy.
"Let them fight,"
grunted Strong Belwas, who had once been a champion in the pits. Sir Barristan suggested a tourney instead. His orphans could ride at rings and fight a melee with blunted weapons, he said, a suggestion Danny knew was as hopeless as it was well-intentioned. It was blood the Myronese yearned to see, not skill. Elsewise the fighting slaves would have worn armor. Only the little scribe Missandei seemed to share the queen's misgivings.
"I have refused you 6 times, Danny reminded Hisdar.
"Your radiance has 7 gods, so perhaps you will look upon my 7th plea with favor. Today I do not come alone. Will you hear, my friends? There are 7 of them as well." He brought them forth one by one.
"Here is Kras. Here Barsena Blackhair, ever valiant. Here Cameron of the Count, and Gughor the Giant. This is the Spotted Cat, this fearless Ithoki, last Bellaquo Bonebreaker. They have come to add their voices to mine own, and ask your grace to let our fighting pits reopen."
Danny knew his 7, by name if not by sight. All had been amongst the most famed of Meereen's fighting slaves, and it had been the fighting slaves freed from their shackles by her sewerettes who led the uprising that won the city for her. She owed them a blood debt.
"I will hear you," she allowed.
One by one, each of them asked her to let the fighting pits reopen.
"Why?" she demanded, when Ithoki had finished. "You are no longer slaves, doomed to die at a master's whim." "I freed you. Why should you wish to end your lives upon the Scarlet Sands?"
"I train since 3, said Gogor the giant. "I kill since 6. Mother of Dragon says I am free. Why not free to fight?"
"If it's fighting you want, fight for me. Swear your swords to the mother's men, or the free brothers, or the stalwart shills. Teach my other freedmen how to fight."
Gogor shook his head. "Before I fight for master. You say fight for you. I say fight for me."
The huge man thumped his chest with a fist as big as a ham.
"For gold, for glory."
"Gogor speaks for us all."
The spotted cat wore a leopard skin across one shoulder.
"The last time I was sold, the price was 300,000 honors. When I was a slave, I slept on furs and ate red meat off the bone. Now that I'm free, I sleep on straw and eat salt fish when I can get it."
"Hisdar swears that the winners shall share half of all the coin collected at the gates," said Kras. "Half, he swears it, and Hisdar is an honorable man."
"No, a cunning man," Delirious felt trapped.
"And the losers, what shall they receive?" "Their names shall be graven on the gates of fate amongst the other valiant fallen," declared Basina.
For 8 years she had slain every other woman sent against her, it was said.
"All men must die, and women too, but not all will be remembered."
Danny had no answer for that.
"If this is truly what my people wish, do I have the right to deny it to them? It was their city before it was mine, and it is their own lives they wish to squander." "I will consider all you have said. Thank you for your counsel," she rose. We will resume on the morrow. All kneel for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals, and the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles, and Mother of Dragons,
Missandei called. Sir Barristan escorted her back up to her chambers.
"Tell me a tale, sir," Danny said as they climbed. "Some tale of valor with a happy ending."
She felt in need of happy endings.
"Well, tell me how you escaped from the usurper."
"Your Grace, there is no valor in running for your life." Danny seated herself on a cushion, crossed her legs, and gazed up at him.
"Please. It was the young usurper who dismissed you from the Kingsguard."
"Joffrey, aye. They gave my age for a reason, though the truth was elsewise. The boy wanted a white cloak for his dog, Sandor Clegane, and his mother wanted the Kingslayer to be her Lord Commander. When they told me, I took off my cloak, as they commanded, threw my sword at Joffrey's feet, and spoke unwisely."
"What did you say?"
"The truth. But truth was never welcome at that court. I walked from the throne room with my head high, though I did not know where I was going. I had no home but White Sword Tower. My cousins would find a place for me at Harvest Hall, I knew, but I had no wish to bring Joffrey's displeasure down upon them. I was gathering my things when it came to me that I had brought this on myself by taking Robert's pardon. He was a good knight, but a bad king, for he had no right to the throne he sat. That was when I knew that to redeem myself I must find the true king, and serve him loyally, with all the strength that still remained me."
"My brother, Viserys."
"Such was my intent. When I reached the stables, the gold cloaks tried to seize me. Joffrey had offered me a tower to die in, but I had spurned his gift. So now he meant to offer me a dungeon. The commander of the city watch himself confronted me, emboldened by my empty scabbard. But he had only 3 men with him, and I still had my knife. I slashed one man's face open when he laid his hands upon me, and rode through the others. As I spurred for the gates, I heard Janus Slynt shouting for them to go after me. Once outside the Red Keep, the streets were congested, else I might have gotten away clean. Instead, they caught me at the river gate. The gold cloaks who had pursued me from the castle shouted for those of the gate to stop me. So they crossed their spears to bar my way."
"And you without your sword? How did you get past them?"
"A true knight is worth 10 guardsmen. The men at the gate were taken by surprise. I rode one down, wrenched away his spear, and drove it through the throat of my closest pursuer. The other broke off once I was through the gate, so I spurred my horse to a gallop and rode hell-bent along the river until the city was lost to sight behind me. That night I traded my horse for a handful of pennies and some rags, and the next morning I joined the stream of small folk making their way to King's Landing. I'd gone out the Mudgate, so I returned through the Gate of the Gods, with dirt on my face, stubble on my cheeks, and no weapon but a wooden staff. In rough-spun clothes and mud-cake boots I was just one more old man fleeing the war. The gold cloaks took a stag from me and waved me through. King's Landing was crowded with small folk who'd come seeking refuge from the fighting. I lost myself amongst them. I had a little silver, but I needed that to pay my passage across the narrow sea. So I slept in septs and alleys, and took my meals in pot-shops. I let my beard grow out and cloak myself in age. The day Lord Stark lost his head, I was there, watching. Afterward I went into the great sept and thanked the 7 gods that Joffrey had stripped me of my cloak.
The Stark was a traitor who met a traitor's end.
Your Grace, said Selmy, Eddard Stark played a part in your father's fall, but he bore you no ill will. When the eunuch Varys told us that you were with child, Robert wanted you killed, but Lord Stark spoke against it. rather than countenance the murder of children, he told Robert to find himself another hand.
"Have you forgotten Princess Rhaenys and Prince Aegon?"
"Oh, never. That was Lannister work, Your Grace."
"Lannister or Stark, what difference? Viserys used to call them the usurper's dogs. If a child is set upon by a pack of hounds, does it matter which one tears out his throat? All the dogs are just as guilty. The guilt..."
The word caught in her throat. "Hazael," she thought, and suddenly she heard herself say,
"I have to see the pit," in a voice as small as a child's whisper. "Take me down, sir, if you would."
A flicker of disapproval crossed the old man's face, but it was not his way to question his queen. "As you command." The servant's steps were the quickest way down, not grand, but steep and straight and narrow, hidden in the walls. Sir Barristan brought a lantern, lest she fall. Bricks of 20 different colours pressed close around them, fading to grey and black beyond the lantern light. Thrice they passed unsullied guards, standing as if they had been carved from stone. The only sound was the soft scruff of their feet upon the steps. At ground level, the great pyramid of Meereen was a hushed place, full of dust and shadows. Its outer walls were 30 feet thick. Within them, sounds echoed off the arches of many-coloured bricks and amongst the stables, stalls, and storerooms. They passed beneath 3 massive arches, down a torch-lit ramp into the vaults beneath the pyramid, past cisterns, dungeons, and torture chambers where slaves had been scourged and skinned and burned with red-hot irons. Finally, they came to a pair of huge iron doors with rusted hinges, guarded by unsullied. At her command, one produced an iron key. The door opened, hinges shrieking. Daenerys Targaryen stepped into the hot heart of darkness and stopped at the lip of the deep pit. 40 feet below, her dragons raised their heads. 4 eyes burned through the shadows, 2 of molten gold and 2 of bronze. Sir Barristan took her by the arm.
No closer. Do you think they would harm me?
I do not know, Your Grace, but I would sooner not risk your person to learn the answer. When Rhaegal roared, a gout of yellow flame turned darkness into day for half a heartbeat. The fire licked along the walls, and Dany felt the heat upon her face, like the blast from an oven. Across the pit, Viserion's wings unfolded, stirring the stale air. He tried to fly to her, but the chain snapped taut as he rose, and slammed him down onto his belly. Links as big as a man's fist bound his feet to the floor. The iron collar about his neck was fastened to the wall behind him. Rhaegal wore matching chains. In the light of Selmy's lantern, his scales gleamed like jade. Smoke rose from between his teeth. Bones were scattered on the floor at his feet, cracked and scorched and splintered. The air was uncomfortably hot, and smelled of sulphur and charred meat.
"They are larger," Danny's voice echoed over the scorched stone walls.
A drop of sweat trickled down her brow and fell onto her breast.
"Is it true that dragons never stop growing?"
"If they have food enough and space to grow. Chained up in here, though..."
The great masters had used the pit as a prison. It was large enough to hold 500 men, and more than ample for 2 dragons.
"For how long, though? What will happen when they grow too large for the pit? Will they turn on one another with flame and claw? Will they grow wan and weak, with withered flanks and shrunken wings? Will their fires go out before they end?"
"What sort of mother lets her children rot in darkness?"
"If I look back, I am doomed," Dany told herself. But how could she not look back? "I should have seen it coming. Was I so blind? Or did I close my eyes willfully so I would not have to see the price of power?"
Viserys had told her all the tales when she was little. He loved to talk of dragons. She knew how Harrenhal had fallen. She knew about the Field of Fire and the Dance of the Dragons. One of her forebears, the 3rd Aegon,
had seen his own mother devoured by his uncle's dragon, and there were songs beyond count of villages and kingdoms that lived in dread of dragons till some brave dragon-slayer rescued them. At Astapor the slaver's eyes had melted. On the road to Yunkai, when Dario tossed the heads of Selar the Bald and Prendal Nargazin at her feet, her children made a feast of them. Dragons had no fear of men, and a dragon large enough to gorge on sheep could take a child just as easily. Her name had been Hazea. She was 4 years old. Unless her father lied.
He might have lied.
No one had seen the dragon but him. His proof was burnt bones, but burnt bones proved nothing. He might have killed the little girl himself and burnt her afterward. He would not have been the first father to dispose of an unwanted girl child, the shave-pate claimed.
The sons of the harpy might have done it, and made it look like dragon's work to make the city hate me.
Danny wanted to believe that. But if that were so, why had Hosea's father waited until the audience hall was almost empty to come forward? If his purpose had been to inflame the Meranese against her, he would have told his tale when the hall was full of ears to hear. The shave-pate had urged her to put the man to death.
"At least rip out his tongue. This man's lie could destroy us all magnificence."
Instead, Danny chose to pay the blood price. No one could tell her the worth of a daughter, so she set it 100 times the worth of a lamb.
"I would give Hazael back to you if I could," she told the father. "But some things are beyond the power of even the queen. Her bone shall be laid to rest in the Temple of the Graces, and 100 candles shall burn day and night in her memory. Come back to me each year upon her name day, and your other children shall not want. But this tale must never pass your lips again." "Men will ask," the grieving father had said. "They will ask me where Hosea is, and how she died."
"She died of a snake bite,"
Mo Resnick insisted.
"A ravening wolf carried her off. A sudden sickness took her. Tell him what you will, but never speak of dragons."
The Syrian's claws scrabbled against the stones, and the huge chains rattled as he tried to make his way to her again. When he could not, he gave a roar, twisted his head back as far as he was able, and spat golden flame at the wall behind him.
"How soon till his fire burns hot enough to crack stone and melt iron?"
Once, not long ago, he had ridden on her shoulder, his tail coiled around her arm. Once she had fed him morsels of charred meat from her own hand. He had been the first chained up. Daenerys had led him to the pit herself, and shut him up inside with several oxen. Once he had gorged himself, he grew drowsy. They had chained him whilst he slept. Rhaegal had been harder. Perhaps he could hear his brother raging in the pit, despite the walls of brick and stone between them. In the end they had to cover him with a net of heavy iron chain as he basked on her terrace, and he fought so fiercely that it had taken 3 days to carry him down the servants' steps, twisting and snapping. 6 men had been burned in the struggle. "And Drogon?" "The Winged Shadow," the grieving father called him. He was the largest of her 3, the fiercest, the wildest, with scales as black as night and eyes like pits of fire. Drogon hunted far afield, but when he was sated, he liked to bask in the sun at the apex of the Great Pyramid, where once the Harpy of Meereen had stood. Thrice they had tried to take him there, and thrice they had failed. 20 of her bravest had risked themselves trying to capture him. Almost all had suffered burns, and 4 of them had died. The last she had seen of Drogon had been at sunset, on the night of the 3rd attempt. The black dragon had been flying north, across the Skahazadan towards the tall grasses of the Dothraki Sea. He had not returned. "Mother of dragons," Daenerys thought, "mother of monsters, what have I unleashed upon the world? A queen I am, but my throne is made of burned bones, and it rests on quicksand.
Without dragons, how could she hope to hold Meereen, much less win back Westeros?